Hi folks, hope you're well. This is Jim Carroll saying hello and welcome you to the latest Bantercast, the weekly podcast from the team behind the Banter series of talks and events. At Banter, we put on events in spaces and venues of all shapes and sizes. We invite a range of interesting people to come along to talk to us, tell us about their lives, tell some stories and discuss various topics and themes. We record what happens in the room and then we podcast the results. Everyone in Ireland has got an opinion of what our TDs do for a living, so what is it that gets them into politics in the first place? We were joined by Kildare North TD and Social Democrats co-founder Catherine Murphy at Other Voices in Dingle to talk about her political activism, life as a public rep, the Irish parliamentary system, new politics, the Social Democrats and making the headlines.
Okay, hi folks, welcome back to Banter here at Foxy John's. We are joined by, you're the first TD we've ever interviewed at Banter, Cashin.
Oh.
You're the first TD, okay. Yeah, you are, you're the first TD we've ever interviewed. Please welcome Cashin Murphy, TD and co-founder of the Social Democrats. So I just had a kind of a start there, I was thinking like, yeah, you are the first TD who has ever sat in the Banter hot seat.
Right.
I know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, you know?
But we know at the end.
Okay, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I suppose, you know, people here would know you from kind of like the Social Democrats. They'll know you from kind of like, I mean, various questions you've raised in the Dáil. But I want to go way back. I want to go back to kind of like, I mean, the early 80s, you know, when you got involved in political activism for the first time. What was it that kind of caused you to actually get up and do something?
Probably if I could describe what, I would have had, if you like, a background in that my family would have had an interest in politics. I would have grown up with the rows between my dad and his brothers, and which kind of took two sides to things. And then I'd seen things growing up, like I remember a big industrial dispute in the 1960s that my father was involved in. And you could see that there was two sides to something. He was on the worker's side, and there was a big dispute, yeah. Big building dispute that went on for months. And there was a gang of us as kids, so it was fairly marginal about, you know, putting bread on the table. And that was something that kind of was quite quite formative, if you like. So essentially, the early 1980s, we had been all out marching about the unequal taxation system. When you're walking a protest that has several hundred thousand people on it, you know you're in a big protest.
Yeah.
And
that'll be the 1979 POE march.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and then a new government came, was elected, and they were going to broaden the tax base. So they introduced what was called service charges. So they were going to ask the same people to pay, but pay in a different format. And a lot of us got pretty angry about it, and it kind of feels like I've come the full circle.
Totally,
we were talking about water charges and bin charges at that point, but it was really about an inequality in terms of how taxation was collected and who it was collected from, and about the provision of services. Even at that point, you know, you saw the money going out, but you didn't see what you were getting in return for it. And I think it's pretty much the same thing now.
Yeah, but like, I mean, back then as well, like, where were you living at that stage? Was it West Dublin?
No, we'd moved to Leixlip from Dublin for a lot of the same reasons people move. That was what we could afford. That was another aspect of what kind of, I was wondering who was making these daft decisions where you would build a whole collection of houses and then the builders would fold up their tents and you'd be left to do, the community would be left to do the real construction project, and that was the constructing the community. A community that wouldn't have, when you're talking about new communities that wouldn't have had that sense of place or associational life and that kind of stuff. So the communities were left to their own devices, and like you were campaigning, you were out with placards looking for, you know, when you were going to get the school to go along with the kids, and you know, bus services and all the kind of things that you would expect to come when you get a large population. So I really got pretty angry about it and said, who's making these decisions? And it kind of I then said, well, what's the best vehicle I can use to kind of to actually do something about it rather than moaning about it?
And like, you know, I mean, I remember you said in some interviews that you were a person who wrote letters to the editor. Did you find, did you were you writing letters off to the local editors all the time?
I was, yeah.
Did it do any good?
No, it got it off my chest, but that was it. But no, I thought you'd have to actually get involved and mobilise and help to mobilise people. Like, we're very passive kind of politics that tends to, if politics is something that's done to you. We've only got 2% of the population that are actually members of political parties, and mostly they disappear between elections. They're only election machines. And essentially, if you know, I actually quite like the idea of a more active politics. It doesn't always have to be about negative things. It can be very positive things, because we have a kind of a unique flexibility that if you could actually dovetail that flexibility with the political system, I think it would be absolutely amazing. Yeah. Because people are very willing to take on things, if there's something that needs to be done, but we don't actually harness that.
Yeah.
And that's the kind of politics that I felt I was involved in the 80s.
Yeah, that's interesting you say about that 2% catching, because it's like, you know, often you get the feeling that some political parties don't actually want people to be bothering them in between elections. All they want is people to come out, take the posters up and stick them up on the nearest telephone pole, and good luck, goodbye, and the next election comes around.
Yeah. That's exactly how it is. Yeah. And what they do is they disappear into things like, you know, residence associations and football clubs and things like that in between. It's not that they're not active in their community, but they're certainly not politically active.
Yeah.
You know, in any kind of a meaningful sense.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, let's go back then to kind of like, I mean, I suppose when you got involved in kind of like campaigning and getting people together, you know, did you find you were natural at kind of like bringing people out of themselves and getting them involved in things, or was that something you kind of learned as you went along?
I definitely learned it when I went along. Like, my best emotion is anger, when I just really kind of when it goes to a point, saying, well, now that's enough, I'm going to do something about this. And you'd kind of see other people kind of coming to the same conclusion on things at the same time. Would have been involved in kind of doing big surveys with other people to get public transport, like, you know, kind of maybe asking 3,000 people for their opinion on public transport in the general area. Worked with, for example, some of the public services providers, the public transport providers, and we matched the needs, and in actual fact achieved quite a lot in terms of, but people felt that they wanted to do that, you know. Lots of different campaigns, from playgrounds to water charges to, you know, better planning, more like planning rather than development. We've a lot of our laws that are talked about as planning laws are really developers' laws, but in actual fact, when you start looking for the planning part, where you knit the other bits and pieces together, they're largely absent.
Yeah, and like, it's interesting because everything you've kind of talked about here in regard to the 1980s, all the campaigns you got involved in, all the actions that had to be done. You said deja vu earlier on. They're all these exact same things as today. And, like, you know, there's a quote you have, kind of like an interview you did during the year, and you kind of said that the fact that, like, we don't do long-term planning in this country at all.
No, we don't. And essentially, it's almost the purpose of politics is to get elected and survive, you know, and give little bits and pieces around the place, rather than having a kind of a vision of where we might be in 20 years' time, what will take us from here to there. Like, we don't know what good public services are because we've never had them. We don't know what a real republic looks like because we've never had it. A republic is about people being equal to each other. It's about rights and responsibilities. And I'm actually quite enthusiastic about us having the kind of republic that we deserve. I think it's a good way of governing where people have, but we have never done it in any kind of a meaningful way. You have to engage people to do it in a meaningful way, and there has to be almost a civic responsibility and a civic morality as well that goes along with that. And you have to have some sort of structure to actually deliver that. But I mean, we've had a whole lot of systems that we've inherited. We inherited our legal system. We had a great legal system before we were invaded. It was called the Breton Laws, and you go back and look at it, and it was very well respected and all that kind of stuff. And it was very unique to us and in tune with our culture, if you like. We had an education system that was largely inherited. We'd a health system that was largely inherited. We'd a local government system that was all about control. It really came out of the the shiring of counties, and was about then putting a sheriff in to kind of control the population. And that's what we still have. And it really grates against the kind of flexibility that is so dominant in what we do. Like, somebody gets sick in a community and all of a sudden there's huge big fundraisers and there's, you know, people coming out of the woodwork, and it's part of the reason why we have so many charities. And charities doing things that really should be public services, you know. Charities around rehab for people who've had catastrophic injuries in the car crashes, for example, or people that are, you know, have mental health problems, and there's all these suicide charities, and now we see people now dovetailing on those with Section 110 charitable status things, where they actually get tax relief for doing things that should be done as public services.
Yeah.
But we won't get to the point of having public services that people can rely on unless we do it deliberately. And we constantly get things like, for example, we're told, OK, that's another piece of legislation passed, so that's the policy. That's a bit like an architect drawing an absolutely beautiful building and you're saying, OK, that's it now, but you actually have to go and build it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
OK, let's go back to kind of, like, I suppose, your first engagement then with like, elected politics, you know? And, like, you were elected to Leixlip Town Council,
yeah.
You were elected to Kildare County Council. Did it take a big effort for you to persuade you to run, or were you kind of like, going, damn it, I'm going for it?
No, I was talked into it. Got the same. Definitely was the reluctant politician. There's no two ways. It never even occurred to me. And actual fact, most people don't think of themselves in those kind of roles. We've only actually had 4 town councils. They're all abolished now. We only had 4 town councils established in the history of the state. And my local community had actually petitioned for that because they felt that, and that was Leixlip, they thought that Kildare County Council didn't actually know we were there.
Yeah.
It was about 15,000 of us, but we were just, like, it was on the fringe, if you like. And a lot of us had moved from Dublin. Other people had moved from different parts of the country. It's a real melting pot. And so we petitioned to have this town council, that we'd have some control over our own affairs. And I've got to say, then we got it in 1987 or something. We were a bit surprised. And then there was 9 people elected to it. And I was talked into putting my name forward, and there was 2 of us on, had joined the Workers' Party at the time because it was a campaigning party, and the two of us ran, and actually we both got elected with a surplus on the first count, which was a bit of a shock.
All politicians, though, Catherine, remember the votes they got, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, you do, yeah, yeah. You remember the ones you get when you don't get elected as well. Like, I mean, I was sent for a holiday in 2007 when everyone thought I got elected to the Dáil in 2005 in a by-election. And in 2007, I got this sabbatical, enforced sabbatical, that made me go off and get a bit of perspective on things. I know another 1,000 votes would have got me over the line, but look at, you know. Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay, let's go back then. Like, me, after Leixlip Town Council, then you got elected to their county council, so that was a step up. What did you kind of, like, find out? Did you find out that those places, like, me, the town council and the county council, things could be done there? Or, like, were you kind of, like, seeing that all the things you saw, all the things you suspected about planners and developers were actually kind of, okay, this is where it's all happening?
Well, Leixlip Town Council was what was called a town commissioners, which really didn't have much power. But we really kind of punched above our weight. And the very fact that it was new, and that really shows renewal is important. The very fact that it was new, there was no baggage. And we all went in with our own ideas. And what we did was we used the flexibility I talked about. We put loads of subcommittees and we gathered in people that were good at this and that and the other in the community, and had those subcommittees. And in actual fact, we wanted, for example, we'd no Garda station, or we didn't even have a Garda presence, and there was a lot of people wanted to have a sense that they were, you know, that was important. And essentially we just wrote to the Minister for Justice and say, hey, hold on a second, you know, we're not just a bunch of people, we're a town council here, you got to listen to us. And we were a bit cheeky. In actual fact, we got two guards that walked around and were dedicated to the area. In actual fact, subsequent to that, there was a Garda station built. But we did lots of things. We had subcommittees on almost everything. And I've got to say, as an experience, it was one of the most positive experiences in terms of community building, because we used that flexibility and we used it in an institution that we moulded then. And I think it was actually a very positive use. When I got to Kildare County Council, and I'd come from, like, all my family are kind of Dublin, I got to Kildare County Council, and the very first day, when the very first thing that they decided they were going to do was elect people to a sheep dipping committee, and I nearly had a conniption. I couldn't understand, you know, why was this such a priority, and they were fighting each other to get on this committee, you know, and it just.
Were you on the committee?
I didn't look to go on that committee.
They didn't co-opt you onto it, did they?
No, they didn't. No.
So what else besides learning the sheep dipping was important to the people of Kildare did you learn?
Well, I was actually told by the finance officer, because I went with a bit of a reputation, because I'd been kind of the front of for the anti-service charges campaign, and my name was at the end of all the leaflets, and the county finance officer didn't have much time for me. Made life pretty awkward, you know. And others told me that I needn't think I'd be in there with the brush to sweep out the cobwebs and all that kind of stuff, you know. So essentially, I was the only one from my party on the county council, and it was. I had to figure things out, like some of the language in the letters that you get. They tell you, you know, you'd write and you'd look for something like an upgrade on a road or something, and they tell you it was desirable. And it took me about 6 months to figure out desirable actually didn't mean it was going to be done. It meant that they'd like to do it, but they didn't have the money. Yeah. So I had to learn all the language, you know, and work my way around the system, which is... It very convoluted, but yeah. It's actually quite useful to know it, because then when you meet a bunch of people, like a very good example, a playground was something that was being sought. Loads of small kids, and you'd think a playground and a park wouldn't be kind of added extras, but there was people always looking for this playground. So we said, okay, let's go and call a public meeting and elect a committee. And then I was able to say to them, you can do this the easy way.
I told Cash before we started, it's not that hot in here. Then Foxy John decided to come in and go, okay, well, that case, we stick a fire on, so sorry about that. it's not bullets, there's no bullets being shot here, you know.
So you were able to tell a bunch of angry mammies how to come in and how to go in and make their demands, and the bunch of angry mammies got further than I would have got by doing it the way that you're supposed to do it. Like, you go to this committee and then they tell you can't do it, and then you go to the next committee, and then you go to the next committee, and after about the fifth committee, then it goes back to the first one to say there's no money for it. So the bunch of angry mammies went in and thumped the table, and essentially 6 months later they got the playground. So it was great to be in unison with people in a community to get something that was needed and to really bypass all that.
Yeah,
and it's the kind of inflexibility that you see that really we need to strip away at, and we keep on being told that, you know, local government, we've had the biggest reform of local government. We've never had a real reform of local government, and if you don't get your local government system working, where you have decisions made at the lowest possible level, then what you get is you get a disproportionate amount of decisions that should be made at local level being made at national level, and it clutters up your national system. And that's exactly what we have. We've too much localism, too much short-termism, until we start getting all of the structures right, we actually won't get good outcomes from our political systems.
Okay, you mentioned earlier on about, like, I mean, you getting elected to Dáil in 2005 in a by-election. That was as an independent. Before then, like, I mean, you mentioned Workers' Party. You were also a member of Democratic Left, and you were also a member of the Labour Party. You know, so, like, why did you leave?
Well, the Workers' Party split, and it split on some issues about the Workers' Party formed in the early 1970s when the provisional and the official IRA split, and I didn't join it until there was a complete break from that, and it was only the political element of it that I was interested in. But the it split in I can't remember whatever year it was. It's that long ago, but but Democratic Left was founded, and
that was kind of Prince Sister Rossa, Eamon Gilmore.
It was six out of the seven TDs. Tomás McGillagher was the one that stayed with the Works Party, and I went with the split. So I didn't kind of voluntarily kind of keep on joining different political parties, and then although I've got to say I'm probably one of the people in the country that has the most experience of political parties, and I've learned something from every one of them, so I see it as an advantage rather than a disadvantage.
Right, so at what stage did you leave the Labour Party?
The Labour Party, Democratic Left, then merged with the Labour Party, and I was very reluctant. I wasn't sure I was even going to go along with the merger until about the week before. And it was going on for months, and I was resisting that because I thought they were two very different political organisations, and I didn't think that they'd work very well, and I didn't think I'd be particularly welcomed in the constituency I was in. And what I really learned out of that was I should have really trusted my own judgement. And I come back and I remind myself of that from time to time now. And I stayed in it about 3 years, and I've got to say it was probably the most miserable 3 years of my life. I left and just woke up one morning and said, "Oh, life's too short for this."
Yeah.
And I just when you're fighting people within your own organisation, it's
yeah. What were you fighting them over, Catherine? I mean, what were there certain issues that kind of came to a head?
No.
Yeah.
No, there wasn't. It was just being there.
Yeah.
So I woke up one morning and then I decided I was going to declare I was an independent.
Okay.
And then I contested a town council and a county council election the following year, and I did very well.
Yeah.
The grand,
since 2005, you stood in the by-election and got elected. Just one question then, you were in a situation where, you had a party around you, so next thing you're an independent. Putting the structure around, getting the people, because I'm assuming you didn't go up every telegraph pole putting up your posters. You had to get a team around you.
Yeah, the same people that were always around me. In actual fact, as an independent, I had more people help me than I ever had when I was in a political party. Probably up to the last election. It's amazing the number of people that will, would volunteer to do things with you and for you and in conjunction with you to get things done. I doubt I would have been able to or would have even thought about contesting as an independent had I not been in a political party first. But having had the experience and it wasn't that daunting, and I knew what was needed in terms of a local election. But then the by-election came up, and I was just sitting watching it on the television and said Charlie McCreevy was being kind of banished to Europe because Fianna Fáil had done very poorly in the local elections in 2004. And it's a nice banishment when you get a promotion somewhere else, but anyway, that's how we do things, unfortunately, in this country. But anyway, I was looking at the television and said, I think I could win that, and because I'd contested general elections before, but I thought where I was positioned in the constituency, the geography would work very well, so I contested and won it, which was a tall order. One day, I think we counted to 8 ministerial cars in a housing estate. When you were contesting an election as an independent, you could see that everything was being thrown at this and on the other side. So.
So you walk into the Dáil then, first time as a chocolate Dáil. I mean, you've arrived in many ways. This is kind of like, this is national politics, Did you find it like me and just the same as dealing with county councils in some ways?
No, there's far less flexibility in terms of the agenda of the Dáil. It's a little bit better now in that there's, the variety, and there's certainly variety. But you nearly have to disrupt things to actually create something different. And
when you say create something different, do you mean to get attention or you mean actually to get something done?
In actual fact, I thought there was less opportunity to get things done in the 2002 to 2007 election. And the last Dáil, there was a very big majority. Now there's the balance has kind of distributed power more to the Dáil than it has to government. I think it's going to take a while for that to balance out. But it's actually quite useful to have experience that those three different, the three different makeup, the makeup on three different Dáils.
Yeah. Okay. Let's go back to kind of like me in 2005. Then, you know, the first time you go in there, I'm always kind of curious, but there's always photographs in the paper that the day the first day, the new TD arrives in. You've got your people with you. If you're a Healy Ray, you've got hundreds of people up in Kerry. You know, so you arrive in. You know, are you shown around? I mean, like what happens? You know, do they I suppose delegate a artist liaison officer? Do they delegate a new TD liaison officer to show you around?
Yeah, like the Dáil is very fragmented. There's no one place that you get all the information from. You get information in one bit from this place and you've got to figure all that out. And that takes ages to figure that out. Even the corridors, even getting lost in the place can happen. I had hooked up with some independents. I'd contacted Tony Gregory and they had set up a technical group. So some of them came out and gave me a bit of a hand during the by-election as well. And so when I was elected, I wasn't elected without being part of a technical group that would allocate a time and things like that. Learned a bit about that, how you can put a technical arrangement where you're not looking at all having the same policy position, but where you can actually use the various privileges in terms of speaking arrangements, committee membership and things like that. And there were people there that I would have been able to ring or talk to on it, okay, so it wasn't too bad.
Right. So 2005 and 2007, the general election comes along and the voters of Kildare say no to Catherine Murphy. Does that give you a land?
Oh, yeah, yeah. You know, anyone that says, that doesn't matter is not telling you the truth. It's a horrible experience. It's a public hanging. That's what it is. And you do feel it, but essentially people were voting very much with their pockets that time. They knew that there was something bad coming down the road and they felt, well, let's keep this gang in place. You know, they know how to organise it so as that it'll mitigate against the worst. And in fact, the crash then came the following year. It was going to happen anyway.
Right. So, okay. So then, general election 2011, general election again this year. You're re-elected.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. I want to kind of, I suppose, move things on then, kind of to, you know, the new party, you know, and like the formation of the new party, and like you're elected as an independent. You're hooking up with all the other independents inside. You're kind of noticing there's a kind of a mixed crew of people coming on. At what stage did kind of like mean yourself and Roisin and Stephen Donnelly as well as decide that, okay, we can do something else here. There's room for manoeuvre. There's room to do something else here with a new political party.
Yeah, I can't tell you how often people said to us, I'd love to join something. You know, just every time you go out, people would say, I'd like to join something. They can't really join you as an independent if they're in a different constituency, for example. But we looked upwards and downwards at what was possible that wouldn't be a club, if you like, because I think political parties can become clubs. But the practice of politics is really important. How do you actually push it out to involve people in a way that's meaningful? So we looked at how we might shape it. We didn't have much time because by the time we decided to do it, it was 6 months, as we didn't know if it was going to be 6 months. It could have been 3 months before a general election, but as it happened, it was about 6 months before a general election. So it's a tall order to even to put together a general election in one constituency, but to do it I think we had 14 candidates, to do it in 14 different constituencies was a tall order, given that we hadn't any money and we hadn't any staff that you would get if you had contested previous, because it's all the funding is all historical.
Yeah.
What we did was we decided to put a shape on it, so as that we have, and we've only now put a shape on it so as that we have a what's called a national council. And what we're going to do now is we want to look outwards at policy formation. We want to draw people in. They don't have to be members of the party. If somebody has a contribution to make to policy formation on housing or, you know, transport or justice or culture, we actually want to develop policy with people.
Yeah.
And that's not always just experts, you know, or academics. It's people who've direct experience, service users, service providers, people, you know, who are disgruntled.
But obviously you want people to come in as well, Catherine, who, like, I mean, share the same ethos and share the same philosophy that social democrats have, which is, I mean, like, if you were to recruit everyone in the room, how would you sell it? I mean, what is the social democrats
well,
right
first
now?
First of all, we set out a number of values and we defined what we meant by those values. We talked about sustainability, for example, and we mean that in, obviously, you know, environmental, but, you know, economic as well, sustainability and social sustainability, things like democracy. And we mean that in the broadest sense of the word, about actually people being involved in the decisions that affect our lives and, you know, designing systems that actually allow them to interact. We talk about progress because we want to be progressive. We want the country to be progressive in that. I would say progressive, and I maybe it's deemed as a kind of a left wing thing, but I'd be progressive from a social point of view. You know, there's some of the values that we put in place, and then we kind of set out to say, look at. We think social democracy is a good tool here. We're a small open economy. It's a good political system. We looked around the world and we looked at places where they've done really well, and very equal societies, more equal societies do better. In actual fact, preceding every major crash, you'll find there's a kind of a gross inequality. The 1929 stock market crash is a case in point. And so essentially, the more equal societies actually do better. People live longer. Mm. They have better health outcomes. They have the lower levels of crime. All of the social parameters. And if you start looking at countries that have, have very good models of good public services, more equal society, you couldn't go past the like of the Nordic countries, the like of Denmark, Norway, Sweden, Finland. Mm. And in fact, a lot of their services were developed and their systems were developed under the social democratic model.
Yeah. Bringing that model to bear, I mean, like, all those ideas are really good. And I mean, again, going back to the NHS, which I knew is one thing which affected your philosophy at the very start. But say in terms of that Nordic model, you know, I mean, again, it's a situation that we don't have here. Like, in here in Ireland, we often kind of feel that we want low tax, but we also want all the services you describe as well. Do you think as well it's a mind change as well that you need to bring in?
Well, you see, I think the knocking on doors during general election, I mean, you hear all these pundits talk and all the rest, but there's nothing like getting out and going at door after door after door and getting a kind of a general impression from people. In fact, I think people were there at the general election. They very much said, we want the public services. Like, a fiver back per week to me is no good if I can't be sure that if I get sick, that I can go to hospital or my elderly parent or my sick child or whatever. And people were absolutely horrified by what they were seeing in relation to homelessness. The idea that children were, spending their lives in hotel rooms, that came up door after door after door. People were actually concerned for the quality of life for other citizens, people who they'd never meet. And I thought, wow, I haven't seen this before. I've been banging on doors for over 20 years and I've seen, well, what are you going to do for me kind of thing. Got none of that. This was a very changed changed group of people who had taken stock of the economic crash. And it was very much an election about society and what kind of society we could build together.
Right. So, I mean, like, if you look at the shape of the New Dáil, then, you know, I mean, obviously, like, Fine Gael is still the biggest party. But, like, do you think, you know, that sense of kind of caring about other people can be reflected in the makeup of New Dáil?
Well, I don't think it is with this kind of with the Fine Gael and then the confidence and supply arrangement with Fianna Fáil, it's very short term. But there are things that have happened. There's been a complete change in the standing orders, which might seem like boring and nerdy and all the rest of it, but it is how it is the rules under which we organise ourselves. And one of the things, for example, there's now going to be a committee that looks after budgets that's going to be properly backed up with economic, kind of specialists. And essentially what we get to with that is, what have you had two or three choices that you put to the citizens and said, like, we can either do this, that or the other. And they're the choices that we have, because that's where the money, that's how we can fund it. And not everything in politics is about balance sheet, and I want to say that, because too often that is what defines politics. Lots of things don't cost money and don't get done as well. But that is, I think, really something that could make a major change. We might have some grown-up politics if we start talking about the choices, rather than things that are couched in political speak, that people think it's something, they think it's one thing, and in fact it's something else.
Yeah.
That I think it's got to be much more stark in terms of the choices that we actually put out there. But I do think you can't do that in isolation to having a system that takes a longer term approach and is very deliberate about what it wants to create.
It's interesting there, like, I mean, you're talking about, like, I mean, use of standing orders, you're talking about, like, I mean, grown up politics as well. And one thing that you did catch on was with the whole Sizewell controversy. And I'm very fully aware we're talking here with the court case on the moment as well. And my learned friends will kind of remind me of the laws of subject to say, but, like, I'm curious about, like, I mean, how you as a kind of as then an independent TD used the kind of Dáil to draw attention to an issue that, like, a lot of people kind of say, like, I work in journalism, so an awful lot of people kind of say, yeah, they all knew that story, but you can't write about it. So, like, talk me through the process going through your head when the information arrived and you decided I was going to do something about this.
Yeah, well, in actual fact, it goes way back. It took us the guts of a year. I have a board in the office that we'd been constructing we looked at, for example, let me just go back and say, some of it really started when I went on some of the protests for the water charges. And really what I wanted to do was, I wanted to really listen to people. I wanted to dip in between the crowd. And you do get a kind of a bit of an antennae after you've been around politics for a while about what really is informing these things. And people were saying things like, I really hate the idea that they're calling me a sponger, that I won't pay the water charges. It's not really about that at all. Others were saying, how did those metering contracts, how did this group or that group get them? How come the same people always benefit? And I started looking at the metering contracts, and then I started looking at how one particular company got most of them. And then I started digging back through stuff and started raising it in the Dáil. And we started putting together, myself and there was two people working in the Dáil with me. And we started asking parliamentary questions. I got to question number 19 when I finally got the picture. And I could have got it on question one, because there was nothing wrong with the question I asked.
Yeah. Did you find, as you were going through those kind of parliamentary questions, which are questions you raised in the Dáil, did you find as well that, like, you also were kind of putting together more of the picture?
Yeah, it was, yeah. Like, there was things like, for example, that I didn't even know existed, like a relationship framework for banking, you know. I said, well, what is this? Let's see what it is. And then, so we get a big bundle of documents, and it just tells us it really is how... Anyway, it's you had to understand.
It's obfuscation.
You had to keep on going through stuff and understanding what the next phase was. And then I had to look at who was involved in the various... because it did come down to personal... A lot of the stuff is personal relationships. And Eve Horican, actually, she's a sociologist. I think it's UCC. Yeah. And she wrote this book called Rule Breakers. And it really talks about our kind of clientelist approach to doing politics, where the TD does the favour, and then the favour is returned at the ballot box, and that kind of stuff. And usually it's about something that people are entitled to in the first instance anyway. But it, that doesn't stop at the individual citizen level. It goes above, and you start to see people intersecting with politics on a very personal level. And then things happen to work out for those same individuals. So
yeah,
that's how it's kind of structured. So essentially, we looked at it, and we came down to one particular company, and it was called SiteServe. And SiteServe had got loads of contracts, and we had a look at how they got the contracts. And then we were saying, this doesn't add up. Like, this company was very heavily indebted. It had, and it was allowed by IBRC, which is a combination of Anglo-Irish Bank and Irish Nationwide Building Society, which we all own and none of us want, and we're being dragged down by. And essentially, they were selling off these assets or liabilities. And this particular asset was being sold off, and they were allowed to sell them. Instead of putting a receiver in to sell it, they were allowed to sell themselves. So they got KPMG and they got Davy stockbrokers to help them to sell it. And the people who were the shareholders ended up getting money as a consequence. It was sold for 45 million and it was 119 million written off of our money. And essentially, we then discovered afterwards that the shareholders got 5 million of the 45 million. And then we discovered afterwards again that there was 10 million on the balance sheet in either creditors or cash. So the hit was much bigger on our side. And we were saying, this just can't be right, because, and then we started talking to people who were other bidders. And other bidders who said they would have paid more and a lot more. And then we talked to people who had experience of the process. And we sat down for an afternoon and did a tutorial with ourselves and another bidder to find out how the bidding process should work, so as that we actually knew what we were talking about. And in each stage, we understood what we were talking about. And then I started raising it in the Dáil and other stuff like, for example, IBRC had brought in another company called Blackstone, who were US vulture fund, and they brought them in to price some of the assets, and then 3 months later they allowed them to buy some of the assets that they themselves priced. And I was saying to myself, this doesn't add up, So if it doesn't add up for me, if it doesn't add up for the person on the street, I'm in there to represent the person on the street. And that essentially is how I went about it. But it goes to the heart of even what this water charge thing is about. It's actually not to do with water at all. It's about the balance of power. It's about it's about insiders benefiting. It's about all of that.
Yeah. So did it surprise you then? Like, I mean, when you start talking to Dáil and you're saying what's what, and you're talking about SiteServe, that the powerful individuals behind this company, so they went, fuck, what's going on here? We need to kind of like kick up, and they kicked up quite rightly. They kicked up in an amazing way that kind of carries on to today. Yeah. There's a court case going on right at this moment about it.
Yeah. Yeah, there was we got letters and things like that, and
we also got a visit from a bizarre dude called Mark Hollingsworth as well, didn't you?
I did, yeah. This guy was a journalist,
alleged journalist. Yeah, passion.
No, he actually, I think, I think he wrote for one of the Guardian or somewhere, or the Observer
Sunday
or something.
Sunday Times.
Yeah. Oh, so it was Sunday Times, and he was looking to speak to me for some months, and. And it was over the summer, so I agreed to meet him in the September. And it was kind of an odd interview. It didn't feel right.
There wasn't a kind of an open fire behind you or anything like that.
No. It wasn't this friendly like environment or anything like that. But for someone who you were kind of, you know, he was almost combative, really, and. And really only wants to ask the same two questions the whole time, you know, like, what was my motivation? My motivation was about the public interest and the common good. And I kept on saying that. And so anyway, we found out afterwards, we found out, well, there's been quite a sizable story written by Peter Murta, an excellent piece of work in the Irish Times, and he's got Investigative Journalist of the Year, and I think deservedly so for some of the stories that he wrote. But it is about this guy who wasn't a journalist, who wasn't acting as a journalist.
Right, so like Hollingsworth kept pressing you about sources as well, didn't he?
Yeah.
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 And like after the interview was finished, that was in room C of the Leinster House, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Did you sweep the room for bugs?
Not that room, no.
No, did you sweep your offices for bugs?
Well, let's...
let's leave it at that.
Let's leave it at that.
Okay, because it's like it just strikes me that the way he kind of concentrated. I mean, obviously, no one like this had ever kind of come into your orbit before, right?
No, and in actual fact, there's a whole other world out there that I didn't know existed, and that's these companies that assist, the corporate sector. There's a whole lot of them all in a very small location in London that are quite high profile.
Yeah.
All within a square mile, if you like.
Wow. So it's very eye-opening then, this whole experience.
It was. There was, you were starting to say, where's the real power? Where does the real power reside? There was other things in the whole thing as well. Like, for example, there was a share dealing thing that the SiteServe shares weren't worth very much because this was pre the sale. And all of a sudden, before they're sold, before anybody knows they're going to be sold, then there's this big blip, a big spike in the share price. And then I wrote to the stock exchange and I wrote to the Office of Corporate Enforcement and I wrote to the central bank and I said, well, how come these, I mean, who do I talk to about these? And each sent me to the other. So I went around in a circle. So nobody actually has responsibility.
Right.
So we, in theory, have a law, but we don't have any way to prosecute that law.
You said earlier on, Cashin, you kind of said that as you and you're kind of like you, the people in the office, assume Amory Nally and people like that were kind of like piecing together the whole story. You kept the board and you were learning all the way through. I'm not looking for names, I'm not Mark Hollingsworth, but did you have sources within companies who were helping you out?
A range of sources.
All right. Did any of those sources suffer any sort of kind of like discriminatory action as a result of being found out?
I would never reveal who my sources are. And nobody is going to know who my sources are because they came to me in good faith and that's how I'm going to act on it.
Yeah.
So essentially, they can guess, but...
Yeah. No, because that kind of leads on to the next question, which is about, people who... Like whistleblowers, people who kind of, bring forward like this. Do you think the laws in this country are strong enough to protect these people?
I think we're a very small country and, I'm looking at, for example, Jonathan Sugarman, for example, who blew the whistle on Citibank. He's in the news in the last week or so. I think he's going to be doing an interview tomorrow on RTE. But he blew the whistle on Citibank and he's pretty much been ostracised for, 8 or 9 years. He's no income and he's just paid a very heavy price. And you see others then who will be almost, they made a mistake, so let's send them off to some big job in Europe or something, you know. So we have an attitude problem here. And where in theory we have a piece of whistleblowers legislation, I think we've got to accept that there is a responsibility to protect whistleblowers. And it's, I see a lot of them we see whistleblowers that are made to suffer from exposing themselves. So what will happen is people will come through, people like me and others to if you're making an argument on something, and I started making this argument in 2015. This is not in the last, 2014, 2015. And as you say, it's still going on. That court case is a very serious case.
Yeah, I mean, and also, I mean, the whole idea that, like, I mean, someone, I suppose, from a journalism point of view, you mentioned Peter Murta there, and from an investigative journalism point of view, the power of kind of like the ability of rich, powerful individuals to use legal action to stymie investigations of any sort in this country is incredible. It'd be amazing to be able to write about that, but we can't write about that.
Yeah, I think, I mean, there's no two ways, but there's something got to be done about our defamation laws. It actually leaves us very exposed. And if the media is, and I do have an issue with the over-concentration as well of the media, but...
You mean over-concentration of ownership?
Yes, I have, yeah. But the media is part of your democracy. If you can't have something debated or discussed in a way that, you know, doesn't, I mean, you're leaving titles open, for example, to be shut down by one court case, and I mean, that can't be right. But I think there's, you know, I think that's a very significant issue in its own right. I think there's the media is at a crossroads as well. I mean, you don't see big investigative pieces done very often, and I think the, you know, obviously the pieces that Peter Murta did, that had to be backed by the editorial people in the paper as well, and a lot of what we get. On, for example, online or social media, where there's actually more revenue, advertising revenue, is kind of, you know, it's not the big investigative piece. And we could find ourselves very exposed by virtue of the fact that, I mean, I go out and buy papers. I think we should be supporting newspapers that actually will do that kind of work, because it is part of your democracy. And getting stuff free online is grand. But if it's not going to include decent pieces of investigative journalism, I think we're probably, our balance is wrong.
Okay. We've gone way over time, and we could keep talking for another hour, I know. So I'm just going to leave with kind of like, just thank you very much. Some very kind of short questions. How long do you think this current government got before we have another general election?
It could happen any time. I think it could very easily happen next year, but then it could go into the following year. But I don't see it going much longer than that.
What do you make of Enda Kenny? You can pass on some of the questions if you want to.
I'll pass on that one.
next general election, given what you know about the Irish people, and given what you said earlier on about, like, you know, when you were knocking on doors and the kind of like the concern, how many TDs do you reckon the Social Democrats will get next time around?
It depends on how many candidates we run, you know, and that's where we're trying to develop a team at the moment, and we'd like to have people who feel strongly about things in different walks of life, that really, even if they put themselves forward for one term to do something and do something big, unless we actually put different choices out there, you then can't blame the electorate for voting the way they do, because they have to have alternatives, and some of the alternatives are turned up in the form of independence. You know, some of it is, you know, smaller parties and that. But, I mean, that's what our intention was to try and develop something that would be reasonably mainstream, but at the same time take a longer view, and then maybe chart out how you would get there, because it has to be a piecemeal approach, and where we can say all the things that we're against. I think we'll really have to get into the frame where we start saying what we're for and how we're going to get to the place where we actually deliver really decent outcomes. And actually, I think, you know, I think it's perfectly possible. I think we're actually a great people, but we're actually let down by our politics. So we're the ones that are involved in politics. I have to try and change that. And that was one of the objects of setting up the Social Democrats.
Cash Murphy, thank you very much for your time. Big round of applause, Cash Murphy.
Thanks to Catherine for coming along to Dingle, and thanks to Banjo and Other Voices producer Molly King, and Salman, Stephen Andricotti, and all of Foxy John's and Other Voices for the hospitality and help. The Bantercast series producer is Tanya White. Check out thisisbanter.com for news of our up-to-date banter. Plus, you can listen back to all the Banter podcasts to date while you're there. We'll be back next week with another podcast. Until then, goodbye and take care.